Sairam, dear listeners, and today, with great joy and enthusiasm in my heart, me, Arvind from Team Radio Sai, would like to welcome you for another segment of Afternoon Satsang. And today is a special Afternoon Satsang because in most parts of the globe, it is the beginning of a new month, the month of August. And myself and Prem, who has joined me here today, both of us really feel that we are in an August company. But well, that is not the case of only this month. That is the case always, because every moment as we speak and have the satsang in the Radio Sai studios, we feel Bhagwan's presence with us, Him seated on this beautiful sofa that He had blessed with His presence years ago. And therefore, we are always in August company. And in this August company, we would like to take up a satsang on a very interesting topic. Sairam Prem, welcome.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all listeners. It's indeed the beginning of another August, another month. But you know, life just rolls on so quickly. As we noted last satsang, it's been 1 year since we've started, and it's quite a while. And you know, when we started, we thought that will we have so much to talk about? But you know, I think what we've all understood is we're just seated here. We are also participating in the satsang, and it is Swami alone who speaks. And we are the first listeners. We have the privilege of being the first listeners. So we hope that there'll be one more satsang where Swami speaks and we all listen, all of you listeners and all of us too.
Yeah. You know, Prem, to start off, instead of the traditional way of revealing the topic and then proceeding, I thought we can start with one little story that leads on to the topic for the day. And this story, I remember listening, hearing it from Bhagwan during a discourse, when he said that there was once a king who had the habit of, you know, bowing down in humility to every being.
Okay.
It was almost in a resonance and consonance with the song that Tyagaraja used to sing, Yendaro Mahanubhavalu Andiriki Vandanamulu. There are so many great people and I bow down to all of them. So this king, it is not that he had an inferiority complex or anything like that. He was a magnificent and wonderful king, but he had humility. He had genuine humility, and because of which he used to bow down to everybody who visited his court. And this was not liked by the minister. And so the minister tells the king, "King, being the king, it is not right for you to bow down to everyone." So the king, Swami said, that the king tells the minister, "Why don't you do this little thing that I tell you?" What he did was he offered him the head of a goat, the head of a rabbit, and a human head, which was severed from the dead bodies, of course. And he told the minister, "Go and sell these three and come back and tell me what price did you get for each of them." So this is what the minister does. And as Swami narrates the story, the minister comes back and he says that, "King, this is what I sold the rabbit head for. This is the price for which I sold the goat head for. But, O King, there is nobody who is ready to purchase a human head." This is understandable. Even today we see that if it's an animal head, it will be purchased. But a human head, I don't think anybody purchases. And when the minister told this to the king tells the minister that, "See, you know, after death, there is no value for this human head. There is value when there is life. So why not? Why not gather and accumulate more value by bending down that head in humility?" And Swami said, "Humility is one sure shot way of adding value to human life." That was a message Swami gave on that day. That also has a far-reaching message, more than just humility. It says that human life gets value. In fact, human life is defined by values. Values such as humility and so many other values that Swami clubs together as human values. What is the magic of these human values? What are these human values? How do we understand them? How do we practice them? That will be the endeavor of this satsang. Right, Prem?
Right, Arvindan very rightly said, human values, it's not adding value to human life, but they are characteristics which actually give value to human life.
Exactly.
As you said, if these are removed, we are only a corpse and that corpse has no value.
Exactly. They define what is human life.
Right.
In fact, I remember reading, I think it's in the Dharma Vahini, where Swami says that, see, it's the nature of the fire to burn. Fire has to be hot. If it is not hot, if it is not burning, it is not fire. You can't say that it's a fire which doesn't burn. It's a fire which is not hot. No. A fire is defined by its burning nature and its heat. Similarly, Swami says it is the nature of the water to wet. So too, Swami adds that human values are the nature of humans, without which you can't call a human a human.
So it's almost like the spontaneous thing what we do. It's like, as you said, the nature of fire is to burn. Whatever is thrown at it, it will try to burn it. You know, whether it is able to or not is a secondary.
Mm.
But its nature would be to try to burn it.
Exactly.
To try to, bring it to ashes.
Mm.
I remember a very interesting thing one of my teachers in school used to say. You know, she was actually teaching us human values.
Okay.
You used to have this moral science class.
Mm.
We used to call it the moral science or moral art or something like that.
You have one story with a moral at the end of it,
right.
And then further discussions on that.
Yeah. So that should be part of the curriculum then.
Mm.
So this teacher of ours, which much later I came to know, she was actually a Swami's devotee and who's teaching us all Swami's message.
Okay.
She had this very interesting way of putting this forth. She said, when I ask you, what is your name? The first and straightforward thing you would do is, tell me your name.
Correct.
You wouldn't lie. You wouldn't tell me somebody else's name or you wouldn't try to hide your name. So she said the most spontaneous thing for you is to speak the truth.
Unless you're a spy who is supposed to be under...
Unless you're put under some constraint, to go otherwise. So
yeah.
She said, by nature you will speak truth. So she would say that is why truth is your nature. That is why truth is a human value.
Hmm.
And she went on to say that is the very essence of lie detector tests also, right? When you want to test a person scientifically if he's telling a lie or not, they basically what they do is they just read the other parameters of the body.
Correct. They make the person, they hook up a person to the device which can monitor his metabolism, his heart rate, his breathing rate, his pulse, his sweat, the heat produced in the palms, everything. And they say that when a person is speaking the truth, none of these psychological reactions occur because a person is not nervous, a person is most comfortable actually speaking the truth. It's only when a person is lying that there is some kind of stress. Unless, of course, one is a trained liar. Otherwise, there is, for any normal person, which is about 90 to 95% of the people on the face of the earth, there will be sweating, there will be some kind of heat produced, because of which the instrument will be able to say that this person is lying. Not that it knows the truth, but it's just that it's able to detect that something is not right in this body. And therefore, maybe he's telling a lie. So,
right.
As you say, it is the basis of the lie detector test too.
Same thing stands for any other, let's say when you're angry, you behave otherwise. You start trembling, you start sweating.
Yeah, people also say that. He's behaving like an animal.
Right.
He's like a wild dog. They don't say that he's like a human being. So, though theoretically we are not aware, intrinsically we have a feeling of what a good human being should
be. Same thing goes with jealousy. They say you burn from within. Because actually physically you feel that. You feel that physical change happening in you when you're jealous of somebody, when you hate somebody.
Mm.
These are all, I think, biological mechanisms by which the body itself tells you that this is not supposed to be your nature. This is not supposed to be your characteristic. Right?
Exactly. I remember one very beautiful concept that I came across in that DVD called The Secret.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful DVD. It comes along with a book. In that they say that all these emotions that we have, we often think of them as exhaust. Exhaust in the sense that I did something good and the result of that is happiness. It's just like when you burn fuel, what comes is exhaust. So emotions are our exhaust. That's how we usually think.
Right.
We think that this a tragedy occurred to me, and the exhaust of that is that I'm feeling sad. or something nice happened and I'm feeling happy. So we always consider our emotions to be fruits.
Mm-hmm.
But in that DVD, in that program, they give a very nice perspective. They say, don't take these emotions as exhausts or results. Take them as indicators or feedback to you. Which means, if you start feeling frustrated or disappointed, it is your body telling you that what you're thinking right now, what you're speaking right now, or what you're doing right now is not right. So therefore stop doing it. It's more like a reward-punish cycle. You know, when we're training pets, when you're training a dog, if it does what it's supposed to do, we throw it a biscuit, a goodie, a treat. At the same time, if it does what it's not supposed to do, maybe you whip it or you bring it to heel, you punish it. So they say that their emotional system is like a feedback system which is either rewarding or punishing. So when you're feeling happy, when you're feeling good, when you're feeling nice, it is your body rewarding you saying what you're thinking now, what you're speaking now, what you're doing now is good. Continue doing this. At the same time, when you're feeling frustrated or irritated, it is not the result of something. It is just your body telling you now that you should change your thoughts, you should change your words, you should change your deeds. The minute you get onto the good thought, word or deed, the reaction also, I mean the feedback also changes. So it is inbuilt in us. You know, when we see corruption going on, when we see hatred, when we see anger, we get the reaction in our body. You know, we don't feel comfortable, which means it is our own selves telling us, get away from the situation or change the situation, because this, what is being spoken, thought or done is not right. So perfect. It is perfect that we have an inbuilt mechanism that seems to tell us what is right, what is wrong, what is needed, what is not needed.
It's amazing. You know, it's a completely different perspective. And also you can understand when Swami used to say, the true guru is actually within. You know, the guru within will be the best guide for you. And these are all actually different interpretations of that. What is right and wrong is actually known by you intrinsically. And that's why when Swami said education should be that which brings out from within. All knowledge is actually within. All discrimination is within. Nobody needs to tell you that this is right and wrong.
So the process of education is supposed to bring out this latent goodness within every person. And that's why Swami calls it as educare, which is derived from, I don't know if it's Latin or I don't remember, but Swami says it's educare, E-D-U-C-E-R-E, which actually in that language means to elicit. Totally opposite to many places which consider education as the process by which you stuff an individual with information and facts.
Right.
It is not about putting from outside into the person. It's about bringing from the person what is latent and making it patent.
Absolutely. And that's why Swami would always emphasize on educare. When Swami would speak, Swami would always say educare is more important. It has to come from within. And going through the process itself, through education, I mean, it's a different perspective altogether. One is you go through the process of education thinking that you're gaining something.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is you go through the process understanding well that this process is going to bring out something from within.
Mm-hmm.
So you will always look within. You will always look for that knowledge to come from within, rather than looking outside and seeing what I can grab and what I can gather.
And in the process of speaking about educare, Swami would always speak invariably about human values. Now when we think about what are human values, a long list turns up. Nobility, goodness, speaking sweetly, honesty, you know, charity, right.
Interestingly,
generosity.
The walk for values which happens in Toronto. It started in Toronto, it's catching up everywhere now. There the thing is, each one is supposed to adopt a value.
Okay.
And then take the marathon walk.
So courtesy.
So innumerable values. Each one would have their own value. As you said, courtesy, humility, or, you know, being good. I think so many things, even the concept of scouts actually comes from that. You know, you kind of embody some values like this, taking care
discipline,
of elders, discipline,
duty. The beautiful thing is, Swami gives us four pillars. We can call them four pillars or four foundation stones, however we wish to call them. But Swami says that all the human values are nothing but an expression or a reflection of these four values. And Swami boils them down to Satya, Dharma, Shanti and Prema. And I feel that we should definitely spend some time in trying to understand what each of these actually means. And we should elaborate on them with examples, as always, from Swami's life, from experiences with Swami, and from what Swami has taught us.
So having said that, you know, innumerable human values are held in these four. That itself gives us an idea that each one of these is going to be so multifaceted.
Correct.
It's not as simple as we understand them. So maybe should we start with the first one? Swami says Satyam.
Okay.
Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema. To start with, those are the four values which Swami speaks about.
Truth, right conduct, peace and love. These are the four. These are the best translations available in English for these four Sanskrit terms. And that is where the problem actually creeps in. Because though these terms are in Sanskrit, Sanskrit is not so prevalent all over the world. And therefore the English meanings are taken. And in English, Swami points out that the comprehensiveness of the meaning is not often conveyed. For example, when we say truth, we often think it to be limited to speaking what is the truth, speaking the fact. What is your name? My name is Arvind. Then I am speaking the truth. What is your name? If I say my name is Prem, then I am not being truthful. This is definitely a part of truth, but we often think that this is what truth is all about, speaking the truth. And I feel that is where a kind of narrow focus comes in, and it becomes very necessary to understand what Satyam means in its entirety.
Right. And it's a very beautiful connection between speaking truth and the long-lastingness of a truth, you know, everlastingness or
longevity.
The longevity of truth. That actually defines what the Satya is and the different layers of meaning the Satya has.
Exactly. For example, when we take a fact like which team is the football World Cup champion? Now the truth would be to say it's Spain.
Right.
But that holds good maybe for another 1 year. And after that, if again Spain wins the World Cup, fine, okay, for next four more years. But there is going to be a time when somebody else is going to dethrone Spain and become the football world champions. Then, at that period in time, the statement we have made now, if we look back at it, it's a lie. So therefore, Swami differentiates it saying, there is something called Nijam. Nijam means a fact. A fact is going to change in time. It need not be the same always. So that is not Satyam. It is also a part of Satyam, but not Satyam as such. Satyam is Nijam and much more.
Right. And similar thing, I mean, you can take it even day-to-day life. If I ask you, what shirt are you wearing?
I'm wearing a white shirt.
Right. And this fact will last only till maybe a few hours when you go back home and change.
Exactly.
So you're not lying, but what you're saying is not Satyam in that true sense.
Exactly.
And in fact, you know, if you look at it, if suppose there is a deal between two people, and even when a guru is giving upadesh to a disciple, it is said that, you know, when the truth is declared, it's declared three times. It is said, iti satyam, iti satyam, iti satyam. You know, even in Vedas, you come across this thing.
Correct.
The essence of that is, it is past, present and future.
Ah.
That which is constant throughout. It doesn't change. And when you're declaring a truth like that, it says that iti satyam, iti satyam, it is truth in the past, the truth in the present, it shall be truth forever.
Exactly. And so, dear listeners, that is what Swami defines as Satyam. He says that the Vedas also call this as Rutam.
Right.
So, Rutam or Satyam is that truth which does not change in the three periods of time. That is in the past, in the present and the future. And so, mistaking this human value truth to be just honesty or speaking what is the right fact at that time can often become a mistake. I remember Prem reading one story. This story was part of our syllabus in the 9th grade. It's a story written by popular Indian writer R.K. Narayan. And a very nice story, a very moving story. But I feel that story also brings out this apparent contradiction that we are talking about between truth, spoken truth and Satyam truth. So in the story what happens is there's a postman, his name is Thanappa, And Thanappa is beloved of the whole village where he stays, where he serves, because he knows almost every family by their name. He knows their history. He knows their what all they have gone through, what are they going through. So he's like a friend to everybody. And his daily routine consists of traveling all around the village, delivering letters and mail, and at the same time talking to all these people. So he has become like a family member to many of them. And then there is this family where the daughter is supposed to be of an age, marriageable age, and they are not finding a suitable groom for her. So this is the problem that the girl's father keeps telling Thanappa, the postman. Every time they meet, every day they meet, every day he asks the postman, are there any proposals from anybody that have come? Mm-hmm. Are there any letters for me this way? So Thanappa is also aware of how much they have been trying to get their daughter married. And almost after a few years, a proposal finally comes, and the groom side is also happy with the bride side is happy with the groom, and everything is fixed. And it's a matter of great rejoicing for the father, and therefore for Thanappa too, because he has been so intimately involved with all that has been happening. So he's very thrilled. And then what happens is, in the story, on the day of the wedding, of course Thanappa is also invited to partake the marriage feast, because it is such a special day and Thanappa is such a special person, right, for the family.
Mm-hmm.
On that day he notices that a telegram has come for the girl's father. You know, we had a satsang about telegram, how that service has ceased in India. But a telegraph, in those days it was the fastest way and the best way of communicating.
Invariably, you don't even have to read a contents of a telegram to make the recipient anxious.
Correct.
The moment you say a telegram has come, they get scared. They used to get scared.
Yeah, because it would be either a very good news, because people are not able to contain it and they have to convey it, or some terrible news maybe, because it has to be conveyed urgently. The very mention that you have got a telegram would get people a little edgy, you know, nervous or excited or whatever.
Right.
So when Thanappa gets, he does something which a postman is not allowed to do, which is read the contents of the telegram. And when he reads the content of the telegram, he gets to know that somebody very close, that is one of the blood relatives, I think it's a brother or a sister of this girl's father, has passed away. And you know, in India, the custom is such that on a holy day, if something like this happens, it's considered inauspicious and everything is stopped. Now, Thanappa doesn't, though he attends the wedding, he doesn't tell him that a telegram has come. Even when that person asks him, he asks him, Thanappa, any mail for me today? He's in a very happy mood. And Thanappa says, nothing is there, sir. And he partakes of the feast. And the next day, after all the celebrations are done and the bride has left with the groom happily, that is when Thanappa comes and reveals and says, I have made a mistake. This had come yesterday. It's my duty to have delivered it to you, but I told you a lie. I said it has not come. Because, you know, this is left unsaid, but everyone realizes that had he told that, this marriage would have stopped and God knows what would have happened. This marriage is culminating after 2-3 years. And here was Thanappa feeling that same fatherly love for the daughter there. And therefore, it was almost like he put himself in the father's position and he knew that this should not stop. There is no problem if this news is conveyed the next day, because what is done, that person is dead anyway. And this is appreciated by the father and everybody else also. And with just a pat on Thanappa's back, they let go of it. Now the question that I am asking is, Thanappa told a lie. So can we say that Thanappa did not follow human values? That is the question.
And obviously I think everybody would agree that he was more human than, you know, you could imagine if he
went out of his way.
Right. So I think it brings the point that the one who knows a bit of, you know, either side of the event, the little bit of the past and what would happen if the eventuality which would occur if he takes a particular course of action.
Hmm.
So that defines what is that moment's satya, literally. What is the human value for that moment is defined by his knowledge of the past and the future.
And here, as you rightly said, Thanappa had some knowledge, had complete knowledge of the past.
Right.
And he had some knowledge of what would happen in the future had the step been taken. And therefore, he was in a position to follow satyam in a manner where even though he is telling a lie, it is not a lie. And so, I think that brings us slowly to this definition where Satyam requires knowledge of the past, the present and the future, because Satyam is changeless in the past, present and future.
I mean, and when you say this, you always think that how will Swami Satyam be? The one who knows the complete past and the complete future.
You know, in fact, that was his childhood name, right? Satyam.
Right. And Swami would often say that, I am Satya Sai Baba, I never go, you know, stray away from the truth. There's one incident which someone narrated to me. You know, there was one devotee who was going through a very difficult phase in her life. I think her husband had lost a job. So Swami gave her a lot of courage. Swami saying, don't worry, I will speak to one of my devotees, get him a job. Everything will be fine. And every time she would come, Swami would tell, you speak to this devotee, he has a factory and, you know, he will give you a job.
Okay.
Or Swami would say that, you know, this August or this January, Uttarayanam, it will happen. I will make sure he gets a job. And every time Swami would say, and they would have a lot of hope, and it wouldn't happen. The date which Swami would say would come and go. It wouldn't happen. And every time this happened, she felt, why Swami said, and it's not happening.
And well, I think, sorry for interruption, Prem, but I think that that is a common feeling amongst many of us, even to this day. You know, we often think of some of Swami's words and think, why is it that it's not happening? Why did Swami say? Swami knew, I mean, Swami said that, but it didn't happen. Why did he have to make such a statement? Well, it's not that just the devotee faced at that time. Right. Even today it happens.
I think all of us have that thing. So at one point, and this was going on for years, not just a day or two or a few months, for years this was happening. And you can imagine, it's not just a question, because there is so much of turmoil behind this question. So once when she had the opportunity to be alone with Swami, she very accusingly, she said, Swami, why do you lie? You know, why do you give us false hope like this? Why do you lie? Why do you say that it will happen on such a day? It doesn't happen. Why do you lie? Because you tell us to follow all these, you know, virtues and values, but why do you lie? And Swami became very stern, and, you know, Swami looked at her right into her eye and said, see, I have only one goal, or my mind is fixed only on one thing, that is your welfare. Whatever I do, I should benefit you. And Swami said, I know exactly when your life is going to change. I know exactly when your problems are going to get solved. But my motive is that till that day comes, I have to keep your hopes alive. I should make sure that you go through this period of life, which you are supposed to, with least damage. And Swami said, if that calls for me even speaking lies, I will not hesitate.
Wow.
And you know, this also brings in the idea of compassion actually. Where truth, when it comes, when the mixture of knowing the past and the present and that of compassion and love comes, that truth actually modifies itself. What is meant to be true that time, I mean, the idea of truth completely changes, right? Just like how you spoke about in Tanapa's story.
Exactly, Prem. And that actually, you know, brings us to the question, what exactly is Satya then? What exactly is Satya if facts can change? Today Mount Everest is the highest peak, tomorrow it may not be. So me saying that Mount Everest is the highest peak need not be the truth. At the same time, if Swami says, say, Kanchenjunga is the highest peak, we may think that it's a lie, but 10 years from now it might become. I mean, we have no idea. So one thing we have understood is truth is something that is changeless for past, present and future. But what is actually Satya? I think we will talk about that with interesting insights from Swami after this little break that we take. Dear listeners, please be tuned in. Something very, very interesting is coming up, and we shall discuss that after this song break. Here is a beautiful song that sets us questioning and asking. I mean, it doesn't set us questioning actually, it sets us thinking. It's a song in Kannada, but the feel and the meaning of the song is that I am everything. I am the truth, I am the light, I am the darkness, I am happiness, I am sorrow, I am everything. We are playing this song because this has got a very intimate relationship with what is actually Satya. Ooh.
సత్యనాను సాయి నాను ఆత్మనాను చిదానందరు పరబ్రహ్మనాను సత్యనాను సాయి నాను ఆత్మనాను చిదానందరు
Dear listeners, though that song was in Kannada, I think most of you would have understood the meaning of that song because it had a lot of Sanskrit words and words which are very commonly heard in Swami's discourses also. But nevertheless, Arvind, I think maybe you could quickly give us a brief of that song as you understand the language.
Well, Atmananu, Chidananda Rupananu, it says that I am the soul, I am the Chit Ananda, that is the consciousness, I am bliss, I am indestructible, I am infinite. I don't have a country, I don't have a kala, a time, I don't have a caste, I don't have nationality, I have no restrictions. I am that infinite. And I am Satya, I am Dharma, I am Sai, I am everything. You know, I think the singer imagined Swami's message to be like this. But as Swami always says, I am God but so are you. This is what applies to all of us, and Swami says that is the only truth. The only truth is that everything is one. Everything is one. If, again the next question, you know, that comes spontaneously to the mind is, if this is the only truth and this is what has been reiterated again and again, if this is the Satya that Sai stands for, why is it so hard for us to accept it?
I think that is because, again, it comes to perception, what you see, what you hear, and going absolutely by what you see and what you hear. You know, when you do an experiment, you should have some kind of intelligence to interpret the results which you get in an experiment. The results by themselves will not hold anything.
Correct.
You know, any result, if you take any reading, they will only be numbers if you don't know what you're measuring and how to connect those numbers.
You know, in the Bhagwan's 50th discourse, 50th birthday discourse, it was not exactly the birthday discourse, there was a 10-day festival, you know, held during Swami's 50th birthday in 1975, from 15th of November till 24th of November. It was magnificent in ways more than one. You know, for starters, Swami himself supervised everything, from the construction of sheds to the sanitation work, to the accommodation of people, to what should happen on each day, and lot of things happened during the 50th birthday. For instance, apart from Bhagwan giving darshan in a helicopter, there was the inauguration of the Sarvadharma Aikya Stupa, there was the inauguration of the Gopuram, the Ratotsavam that is held every year on the 18th of November, started actually in that year. That was the year when Swami inaugurated a police station for Puttaparthi. He inaugurated the Gokulam. And a new school building for the Ishwarama school was inaugurated. So in every sense, the 50th birthday was a landmark event. And even in terms of teachings. You know, Prem, sadly, I checked I checked through the Sanatana Sarathi and the Satya Sai Speaks,
mm-hmm.
all the issues that have come, sadly only two discourses that Swami delivered during the 10-day period has been documented there.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually 8 discourses that Swami delivered in that 10-day period.
Mm-hmm.
And during that 10-day period, there were 3 conferences held. There is a reason why I am telling all this.
Okay.
There were 3 conferences held during that birthday season. One was a Balvikas conference, one was a Balvikas Guru's conference. One was a Balvikas Guru's conference, one was a Sevadal conference.
Right.
And one was a Second World Conference.
Right.
And all the discourses that Swami gave defined things for each of these wings of Swami's organization. That is the Sevadal, the Balvikas, and the international organization, Satya Sai organization. It is sad that these discourses are not recorded, and there were no audios also until recently, when our very enthusiastic and supremely superb Telugu team managed to locate cassettes recorded by a person who sat with a Walkman and, you know, recorded these discourses, and therefore we have chanced upon this treasure. And dear listeners, soon we will be making most of these things public for everyone to listen and enjoy. In one of those discourses, Prem, I heard a shloka, mm-hmm. a poem that Swami often has used, but I am sure nobody would have heard it in this way. You know, we often hear Swami saying, there's only one caste, the caste of humanity. There's only one religion, the religion of love. There's only one language, the language of the heart. And there's only one God, He's omnipresent. But in that discourse, Swami said, there's only one God, and He is Satya Sai. And everybody applauds.
Mm-hmm.
Swami immediately comes back and corrects and says, when I say Satya Sai, it doesn't mean this 5-foot frame. Satya Sai is one who is Sai on Satya, which means one who rests on Satya is Satya Sai, not this form. And Swami says that Satya is the only God. Truth is the only God. And why I said this was, we were discussing about the experiment where we need to have intelligence to interpret what is the result.
Right.
And intelligence is derived from what we perceive. And during the course of the discourse, Swami said, you know, if you see, when you sit in a car, you feel you are moving. When you sit on a bullock cart, you feel you are moving. When you sit in a bus, you feel you are moving. But if you stand on the ground, you feel you are not moving. Anybody will look and say that this person is standing stationary. But the truth is, every second the earth is moving at so many miles per second speed, and thousands of miles per hour, that is the speed of the earth's revolution. So actually, when you think you are standing stationary, you are moving at such tremendous speeds. But nobody will ever tell you that you are moving. Everybody will say that you are standing. Why? Because what you perceive and what is the truth are two totally different things. And then Swami went on to give another example, that of the wall.
Right, I think that is also quite often used even in the science circles, scientific circles, you know, where you say that you see an object as solid, but if you go deeper within, what is actually there? That's what Swami was telling, I think, in those discourses, when Swami said, you see this wall now, and you say this wall is solid because you can't see what is on the other side of the wall.
Correct.
But then Swami went on to say, do you know exactly what this is made of? And Swami went on to name these particles. You know,
exactly. He said Anu, atoms, and then he said Paramanu.
Right.
And the protons, electrons, neutrons.
And Swami said, how are they placed in this atom? They are like the stars scattered in the sky. No, they are not like solid. They are in different, you know, spread out in that atom. So literally Swami was telling that what you see as a solid is actually has so much of empty space in it.
He said that just like you see stars in this vast sky, like that in the vast space in the atom, the Paramanu or the electrons and protons are like those tiny stars. So more than 98% of the atom is just empty space. But if you ask a scientist, he will also say that this is a wall. He will never say that it's empty space there. And Swami asks, why is it that when Science has already discovered that it is nothing but empty space, still it calls it a wall, because what you perceive and what is the truth are totally different. And then Swami said, there are people from 46 countries who have assembled in this auditorium. People from all kinds, all races, all castes and all religions. What I am saying is that all are one. And he said, he even quoted Jesus Christ, you know, that all are one, my dear son, be alike to everyone. And he says, you may ask, how is it I am separate, but how can I be one with all? And again Swami said, because it's always like this. What you perceive and what is true are two totally different things.
So I think in the absence of our ability to understand the truth, we have to accept it by those who have understood it. You know, that's what is said, oft said quotation is, a man with common sense is one who learns from his mistakes. An intelligent man is one who learns from others' mistakes also.
Correct.
Because your life is too short to have
making all, your
all the mistakes in the world.
Better learn from others' wisdom. Right. And, you know, day-to-day life, Prem, you take a pink color cloth, keep it against a green background, it looks different. Keep it against a white background, it looks different. In fact, there are so many simple tricks on the internet. You can check it out. With colors. Yeah. Illusions with colors.
Optical illusions.
Optical illusions where you change the background color and the color of the object seems to change. So now what is pink actually? What we think of it as pink, now, you know, for convenience they say whatever you see under white light against white, that is the true color. But in an absolute sense, that is also relative to the white.
Right.
We have chosen to take that as the standard. What if it's placed against green? It's different. And in fact, going a little bit deeper, why does an object appear pink? Because it is reflecting the pink component of light and absorbing all other components. So in reality, it is all the other colors other than pink. But we say it is pink. We say it is that which it exactly is not. See the paradox. What we perceive is totally different from what is actually the reality.
Right.
What is the truth? And therefore, Swami says that though you do not understand, though you are not able to perceive it, the truth, and this is the most important definition, which we will hold on to throughout our satsang and the next satsang also, is that satyam means the one that is changeless in the past, present and future, and satyam is that everything is one. That is satyam.
Right. That knowledge that you are actually not an individual but part of that whole.
Mm.
And it's very true what you're saying about seeing colors and seeing. And we all know it, even biologically, even scientifically. The eye can see only a certain spectrum of light.
Mm.
You know, it cannot. What you see as pink is only the pink component of that light which you're able to see.
It Correct.
May be having so many other components which you cannot see.
Mm.
And you know, and we believe in so many things which we don't see. We believe in all the microscopic organisms which are invisible to naked eye. We believe them because somebody has seen them.
Correct.
You know, we are ready to place our faith on a scientific mind. But on those who have seen the truth, who come and tell us that we all are one, we hesitate because we feel that it is unscientific.
And as you rightly put it, Prem, some things are just beyond our understanding. You know, like if our eyes are not able to see beyond a spectrum, how can I ever say that I want proof that something beyond the spectrum exists?
And
I don't have the capability to see.
And if you say that, I'll believe only what I see.
Exactly, that is stupidity. You know, it reminds me of that interesting example of the 2D world that you told about.
Right. You know, this is a wonderful cartoon which was saying, you know, it was actually trying to explain the concept of God.
Hmm.
And how we will never be able to comprehend the concept of God, but we'll only have to accept it.
Hmm.
So he was saying that we live in a three-dimensional world, you know, where you have the X, Y and Z axis, talking of it mathematically. And if you were to go to a two-dimensional world, okay, and he shows that in a two-dimensional world, there are only two planes. You either move front and back or left or right. There is no up and down.
Correct.
So it is almost like, imagine a surface of the table.
Mm.
You go and look at the two-dimensional world. The people in the two-dimensional world will never be able to understand you because for them, there is no above.
Correct.
And you are looking at them from above. So if you tell them that I'm looking at you from above, they will say that there is no above. There is no above and below.
It's only front, back or right. Left, right.
Huh. Okay. And when you look at it from above, you will be able to see much more than what that object in the two-dimensional world can see.
Correct.
Like suppose I'm looking at this table. I will be able to say that there is this object here, there is a stain here, and so many centimeters away there is another stain. But if you tell that to the two-dimensional world,
you are omnipresent.
You are omnipresent and omniscient.
Exactly.
You know, you are able to see much more than I can see. You know much more than I know. But it is very casual for you because you are living in a three-dimensional world. And the cartoon goes on to say that imagine somebody who lives in the fourth or fifth dimension.
And one who is beyond
natural.
Yes, and one who is beyond dimensions.
Right.
No wonder Swami said that all these miracles are nothing. They are just visiting cards. My greatest miracle is my love. But well, I think we'll be jumping the gun if we go to love. But that is definitely a deep thought for us to ponder on. That all the things that we consider as miracles, Swami would say, what is ascharyam for you, surprise and thrilling for you, is sahajam for me, is natural for me. And, you know, science is also moving towards this satyam. There's the GAIA, Gaia theory, which states that possibly the earth is one big organism. And all of us are different parts of that organism, just like fingers and hands and legs of the human body.
Okay.
So, you know, science too is moving towards that direction, which is able to see oneness and unity in the whole creation. Which means, imagine if they say that the earth is one giant organism, we can no longer think that houseflies are pests, we eliminate them. No, it's part of the body. I can't say that my little finger is irritating, I cut it. No, it'll pain the body. It is definitely a part of the body. And therefore, I take care of the little finger. So, you know, see, taking care, love automatically comes in. All these human values automatically comes in when you are established in this satyam.
Right.
That everything is one. You automatically serve the other person because you feel it is part of me.
Right. And again, it reiterates the point of nature, human nature, the values being a human nature. Like, you know, the moment you say we are one organism and you explain seva as the hand going to help the leg, it becomes an intrinsic thing. You don't think the hand is being
kind, generous.
Right.
Exactly.
So, you know, the act of compassion, the act of going and helping becomes a nature. That is why compassion is a human value. It is a nature of humans.
You don't need a separate corporate social responsibility wing for the hand.
You don't have to be taught to be compassionate. In fact,
Correct.
You have to be taught not to be compassionate.
Exactly. And that is why Swami would say, we need educare. Because these values need not be inculcated. They are already present. They just have to be given a chance to flower and blossom.
And most importantly, you should be told that they are your nature.
Correct.
Don't try to move away from them.
See, now in this light, when we look at the Thanappa story, you know, if he, in that moment, he could feel oneness with the father of the bride, because of that feeling oneness only, he could understand what is the right thing to do. He automatically knew that in spite of him lying, and in the, if he's taken in a very narrow sense, he's not sticking to the values, he knew that that will be forgiven, it will be accepted, and he'll be appreciated for what he's doing. And all that could come because of the oneness he felt with the father. And that is how satyam supersedes nijam, or speaking the fact and speaking, being honest as we take it.
And if you look at it from Swami's point of view, whatever he did was actually in coherence with this satyam. You know, whatever he did for us, whatever he spoke to us, whatever he, you know, whatever he was leading us on to was this truth. So that is why whatever Swami did was actually in coherence with satyam.
I remember one interesting incident. You know, it was during the convocation drama. And I have a special attachment for stories related to the convocation drama. Because I feel life itself is like one convocation drama, where Swami directs, Swami corrects the dialogues, Swami changes the costumes, and Swami only appreciates the drama, and Swami rewards the actors. What happens in the convocation drama is what happens in life too. So during one convocation drama, there was a scene which had to be enacted by the saint and sage Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. And the boy who was supposed to do this role, you know, we know Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, he sings out in adoration to the mother. And the form of the mother that he worships is Mother Kali.
Right.
And so when Swami wanted to come for the rehearsal of the drama, the organizers brought in a statue of Mother Kali. And, you know, we know how Mother Kali's form is. It is really fearsome. The tongue is out and bloodstained. and she wears a garland of skulls. She holds a skull in one hand, in the other hand she holds a cudgel, in one hand she holds a sharp and thick sword, and it's a very, very, you know, fearsome kind of form. But that is the beauty of the mother, you know. With such a kind of form, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa fell in love with. That day when Swami came for the practice, he said, "What is Ramakrishna Paramahamsa worshipping?" Said Swami, "Mother Kali." "No, no, no, replace. Take out the statue is not nice." And Swami asked for a statue of Lord Krishna there, and then said, start the practice session. You know, when this happened, everybody thought, "Oh my God, what is Swami doing?" His name is Ramakrishna, of course. Doesn't mean that he worships Krishna. He worships Mother Kali, and here is Swami tampering with history. So they were very nervous. But Swami would not budge. For the practice sessions, a Krishna statue was being used. And when this went on for some time, they came with an idea, let us use a small Krishna statue. Mm-hmm. So that on the final day when the drama is being done, people will not think of us as fools who don't know even basics of history. Because if it's a small Krishna statue from far, they can't make out whether it's Krishna or Kali. But that ploy didn't work because Swami insisted on that same Krishna statue. And that is how practice sessions went on. And everybody were thinking of the loss of face that will come when the drama is actually put up in public. A day or two before the final day, the D-Day, Swami comes and asks, "What is Ramakrishna Paramahamsa worshipping?" He did not worship Krishna. And he said, bring Mother Kali. You know, that time they organized, they said, fast, you know, get that Mother Kali statue and replace this Krishna before Swami changes his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And after that practice session got over, Swami walks up to this boy who is acting as Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, pats him on his back and says, "Now it is all fine, right?" And then they all see that this boy is in tears. He's just looking at Swami, his eyes are watering, his hands are folded, and he's just not able to contain himself. And when Swami leaves, they ask him what has happened, and then he reveals that when he had to do it first time in Swami's presence and the statue was brought, till then there were no sets and props. That time when the statue was brought, the first feeling he got was, "Oh my God, how ugly the mother looks. I mean, how do I get feelings of love and devotion towards this?" And this boy happens to have his favorite deity as Lord Krishna. Swami knows that Ramakrishna did not worship Krishna, it's only the name. But this Ramakrishna here, who is acting in this drama, worships Krishna. And so Swami got it replaced. And day in and day out when this boy practiced, he said that it became so part of his nature that he no longer needed an external statue. Every time when he acted as Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, automatically the dialogues came and automatically that love also flowed. And once there was no need of an external support for that devotion to arise in the drama, Swami said, "Replace Krishna and bring Kali." And when this was made aware, everybody felt so foolish for having doubted Swami, for having thought that Swami had gone like something, he had gone wrong or he had made some mistake. And Swami is able to do this because he's always rooted in that truth which is beyond time. He's able to see the past, present and future, and he's rooted in the truth that all are one, and therefore he's able to feel oneness with all, understand the heartfelt feelings of each one. And see, ultimately what he did turned out to be the best. And that is what happens in all our lives with Swami. In retrospect, we look back and say, what Swami did was perfect. Why don't we learn from that experience and then know that what Swami is doing now, which is everything that he is only doing because he is the Lord, is perfect for me. Why don't we realize that?
That's one very, very strong aspect which you said, that we can never understand the subtler truths. We go by what is the obvious and the straight truth. We don't know the subtler truth, but then the other aspect of Swami speaking anything is, you never know. When Swami speaks, it has every ability to become the truth even as we understand it.
Correct.
No, I'm reminded of a conversation we had with one of the devotees who came. Mm-hmm. And they are from the 1960s. You know, they came, she was a devotee who came from America.
Mm.
And that was a time when, you know, a lot of these youngsters were taking to becoming yogis in India. They would come and settle. That was the time when the Beatles and all those
bands were.
The bands were also coming to India and were spending some time in some ashrams in the Himalayas.
It was a hip time for being
right,
a hippie.
Right. It was that hippie culture, when they were all into spirituality.
Hmm.
So she was one of those people who came in that crowd, and they went to Himalayas. They were going around, and she really was a sincere aspirant. It's not that it was just a culture which she took to. She was a sincere aspirant. So one time when she was in front of the Ganges, she threw away all her passport, visa, and all her papers.
Why?
Into the Ganges. She says, that I'm not this body, I'm the spirit, and I don't belong to any one country.
Oh, my God, okay.
Okay. And just dumped all her things into the Ganges. And later, after so many years, she came to know about Swami, and she came here, she came to Bangalore. So, amazing. There from America, she showed some pictures of how they used to live in a pump house in the village in Whitefield. And
okay.
Stay there for months and come and have Swami's darshan. And once you come into the city, you have all your problems. You will be asked about your papers, your passports, your visa.
Oh, yes. As long as you're living in the forest and
right.
Himalayas, it's not a problem.
So then, she was beginning to face problems, when you had to rent a house, you'll have to show all these papers and all that.
Hmm.
So they approached Swami and said, Swami, this is what I did, and I need a passport now, what to do? So Swami gave them a solution. Swami said, you go to the local officer, police officer. Swami named a particular officer. And Swami said, you file an FIR as though you've lost your passport now.
Okay.
Saying that you were staying in such and such a place.
Mm.
And somebody has stolen your bag with which all your passport and every paper is gone.
Mm.
Okay, and get your FIR filed that way. And after having filed the FIR, that person will give you a letter which you can go and give it in your consulate, and they will reissue a passport.
Okay.
Okay. So
Swami told a lie.
Right. Apparently, and Swami said, I'll speak to the police officer. So apparently it looked like, Swami is setting this thing up.
Yeah.
And so many others who were there who saw
using his
thing,
influence
right,
and then using a lie.
Using a lie. And those who were there, they felt really offended.
Hmm.
They said, how can Swami be party to something which is so adharmic like this? Something which is so false.
Hmm.
So it seems many of them even left in frustration.
Oh my God.
Not being able to fit in Swami through their idea of what is truth and what is, right.
Hmm.
So these people left, and it so happened, she went and the police officer gave her a letter. And in a matter of few weeks, she got back a passport. She got a passport reissued, which is like unprecedented. You don't get it so easily.
Hmm.
And the best part was, after a few months, exactly the thing what Swami told actually happened. Her bag was looted. Along with that went her passport and visa and everything.
Oh, this new passport which she had obtained.
Right, which was reissued to her. The same scene which Swami told her to describe that it had happened, actually happened. And
okay.
She had to go through the actual process.
After that?
She went and filed an FIR, and she had to get a letter which she went and gave to the embassy, in which took 6 months of the time which it usually takes.
Okay, okay.
So what Swami said was not actually a lie. It was only a truth which is told in advance.
Swami has said that when you adhere to truth, truth will adhere to you. In fact, that is why they used to say in the olden times that if you get a blessing from a sage, it's a great thing, because what the sage will tell will happen. Even if it is not meant to happen, it will happen because he has adhered to truth all his life. And when we say a person adheres to truth, it doesn't mean he goes about revealing facts always. Because Swami himself says, Nabruyat Satyam Apriyam, which means do not speak an unpleasant truth. So
the whole verse is Satyam Bruyat, speak the truth.
Hmm.
Priyam Bruyat, speak pleasantly.
Hmm.
And Satyam Apriyam.
Na Bruyat Satyam Apriyam.
Na Bruyat Satyam Apriyam.
Do not speak a pleasant, an unpleasant truth. Doesn't mean that you have to speak a pleasant lie also.
Yes.
That follows as a corollary. But if Swami himself says that do not speak the truth if it's unpleasant, it shows that adherence to truth doesn't mean adherence to just stating the facts always. Adherence to truth is living every moment of our lives with that knowledge, with that conviction that we all are one. And therefore, generosity, compassion, love, empathy, all of it comes so naturally because you are part of me. Just like what the hand feels for the eye, what the nose feels for the toe. And even sacrifice becomes a natural tendency, For example, if a toe is injured, if it has to be amputated, the toe doesn't feel that it's doing a great sacrifice. It's for the sake of the body. It's so natural. That is why it is said human values are natural to us. And that is the satya that we have to be rooted in.
And but having said all this, Nilesas, we are not trying to demean the virtue of speaking the truth or honesty. That is
exactly.
Not the thing at all. Because as you said, the one who adheres to truth, truth will adhere to him. Even if you adhere to truth in your narrow-minded understanding of truth, even that will benefit you, isn't it? You know, because that is, it is your, literally your ode you pay to truth. Because what the truth I see is the truth which, the spoken truth. So I stick to it. And you know, what Swami says is, you will be able to stick to that truth if you have no desires. If you have no vested interest, you can always speak the truth.
Correct.
It is only when you have some favors to get from the other, you tend to speak the truth.
Thank you for bringing up this point, Prem, because of course, though we are speaking about what is the actual meaning of satyam, this in no way gives us a license to err or tell lies, because we are sticking to the ultimate truth. This is a mistake that all of us very commonly make. You know, quoting a high philosophy and a high truth, the ultimate thing, when we are not actually living the ultimate thing. When we actually live the ultimate thing, all these need not be thought of and reasoned. Exactly. I think that aspect is important before we close this discussion on satya. And we will do that after the small break that we take, dear listeners. We will come back to the concept of satya and nijam and how it is important to speak the truth also and not use advaita for telling lies.
Satya dharma mo shanti prema lako me vidya jivana yatra saginchu jiva satya dharma mo shanti prema lako me vidya jivana yatra saginchu yatna prayatna mul madava dharma ఇష్ట సుఖములు కర్మలన కండి మన ఇష్ట లోభము కష్టమో నండి పట్టు విడక ఆ పాదము కొలుచిన కట్టు చేచుట తన బట్టేను సత్య ధర్మము శాంతి ప్రేమలతో మీ నిత్య జీవన యాత్ర సాగించు ఎదను విడడు ఎడబాయలేడు మిమ్ము ఎరుచుండు ఏ వేళను సాయి ఎదను విడడు ఎడబాయలేడు మిమ్ము ఎరుచుండు ఏ వేళను సాయి కరుణయే అతడు అతడే కరుణ కరుణకి కాచి పొందండి సత్య ధర్మము శాంతి ప్రేమలతో మీ నిత్య జీవన యాత్ర సాగించు కష్ట సిద్ధుల సాధనెందులకు అది వట్టి భ్రమలతో కట్టివేయుముగా కష్ట సిద్ధుల సాధనెందులకు అది వట్టి భ్రమలతో కట్టివేయుముగా దట్టమైన ఈ జీవితాటవిలో పట్టి నామమే పట్ట పగలో సత్య ధర్మము ప్రేమలతో నీ నిత్య జీవన యాత్ర సాగించు మొదటి పట్టును విడువబోకండి అది పట్టులోనే భక్తి పట్టండి మొదటి పట్టును విడువబోకండి అది పట్టులోనే భక్తి పట్టండి ఎన్ని బాధల పొందిన భగవత్ చింతన మాత్రము విడకండి సత్య ధర్మము శాంతి ప్రేమలతో మీ నిత్య జీవన యాత్ర సాగించు జీవా సత్య ధర్మము శాంతి ప్రేమలతో మీ నిత్య జీవన యాత్ర సాగించు.
What a song that is, Prem. So beautiful. You know, if we, when we understand every statement in this song, this is a song that was composed by Swami, it actually makes us pine for suffering and sorrow, you know, because that seems to be the way to redeem oneself. And that is true also because Swami often tells us the story of how Mother Kunti told Lord Krishna, Lord, fill my life with troubles.
Interestingly, you know, this song, once when Swami sang the song, Swami said, my entire teachings is in this song.
Wow.
And Swami sang this song. Really,
and even
song.
Directly on the face of it, it's totally believable. Because how each stanza deals with one different aspect and so wonderful. I mean, I was talking about the sorrow and pain part because those are the last few paras that were about.
Right.
So beautiful, really wonderful. I think one day we should do a satsang on this song itself, on each stanza of the song, and so that we ourselves get better appreciation and fall in love with this beautiful song. Well, coming back to the topic, Prem, yes, we were speaking about how we should not use this concept, actually misuse this concept that satya is knowing that everything is one and every act done in that realization makes whatever we say itself the truth. How we should not use that, misuse it and justify us telling lies.
And I think as you were saying, the like how we defined when we started with Anapastrut, that was because it was a selfless life, you can say it, you know, what you call a white lie. Because he had nothing to benefit from it.
Yes.
Maybe he would have had to suffer having told a physical lie, you know, if you look at it that way.
Yeah, he might have had, he might have been kicked out of service.
Right. Maybe he thought that it doesn't matter if I have to demerit myself by telling this lie because it's going to benefit somebody. And that is why speaking a lie, not because we are going to benefit from it, is very, very important.
I think that is a beautiful thumb rule. Selflessness when we lie. I mean, if the lie is going to benefit somebody else, and definitely I should not be a beneficiary of that lie. If I am a beneficiary of that lie, by default it makes it a terrible thing to do. In fact, it should be such that I am telling the lie in sacrifice. I am losing out something and somebody else is gaining something. And that is absolute selflessness. And I think that is one nice thumb rule. I don't know if it's an all comprehensive rule.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's not an all comprehensive rule, because I think somewhere that selfishness is there. And you know, one of the best stories that Swami says is that of Gandhi and Putlibai, right?
Correct.
Actually, if you look at that story, Gandhi, as the story goes, the mother is actually undergoing some fast, and when she hears the cuckoo,
she has taken up a fast in such a manner that she will have her meal only after she hears the cuckoo,
right?
Cuckoo sound, the koel sound.
Right. So when Mahatma Gandhi, who's a little boy, then he asks his mother why she's not having food. When she tells him this thing, he goes behind the house and imitates the sound of a cuckoo, hoping that she will eat her food. And then the mother gets very upset. She doesn't talk to him, and she says, she starts crying. Swami has different ways of explaining this. Swami essentially says that how hurt she is as a mother, that because Gandhi has told a lie. You know, in this, if you look at it, it was a very selfless act, because Gandhi did that so that his mother would eat. But here, the mother was very, very insistent that the virtue of being honest should be driven home.
Correct.
Because, you know, that is as important as selflessness. When you have equal importance to both these values, then I think you can have a situation where you can decide what has to be done.
So then we can modify. This is not a thumb rule as a go-ahead. Means we cannot say that if by my lie somebody else is benefiting, then it's okay to go ahead with it. We cannot take it as a go-ahead thumb rule, but we can definitely take this as a level crossing gate stop thumb rule. That is, if somebody is going to either suffer from the lie that I'm telling, or if I'm going to benefit by the lie that I'm telling, definitely I must not state it. So we can take this as a thumb rule for stopping ourselves rather than as a thumb rule for a go ahead.
And again, in many times, you know, when you tell of selflessness or if it's going to benefit somebody, again, it comes of, you know, how benefit, in what way. It may be immediate benefit, but be a long time harm.
Or it might be an immediate benefit for others, but long time it may benefit me actually.
Right.
So it's a very intelligent way.
Again, it comes to, you know, how intelligent you are, how wise you are. Not intelligent, not the buddhi, but how wise you are and how you can.
And wisdom lies in realizing the truth that all are one.
Right.
It comes back to that again and again. And you know, Swami has also given so many practical solutions. He says that there may be times when you're forced into a corner where you're having to say a lie. At such times, he gives different solutions. One of them, he says, is to use tact. We have discussed this previously also in the satsang. And Swami tells the story of a spiritual aspirant who, while meditating, he is disturbed, and when he opens his eyes, he sees a deer running and escaping. It goes and hides in some nearby bushes. And then, short time later, comes a hunter. Swami says that this hunter asks the hermit, "Hermit, did you see where the deer went?" And this is even, you know, mentioned in, I think, Shivratri 2002 discourse. Swami tells the story, Chinakatha. And the hermit says, now, Swami says that this hermit is now, this aspirant is now in a fix. If he says that, yes, I know the deer is here, he's going to be harming a creature, which is against his policy, which is against sinful. If he says, I don't know where the deer went, I will not say. No, that's telling a lie, which is also sinful. Swami says, now it is almost like he has to choose between two evils. And so, our choice would be to choose the lesser of the evils. But then Swami says that this hunter himself was Lord Shiva in disguise, who had come to test this aspirant. And then the aspirant prays. He prays to Lord Shiva. He says, Lord, give me the answer. I don't want to kill a living being. At the same time, I don't want to tell a lie. You know, through that, Swami gives us a hint that in such times, always resort to prayer. Seek God's help, because God will help. And I feel that is the reason why Swami gives this variant of the story. He says he prayed intensely to Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva blessed him with yukti. Yukti meaning tact.
Tact.
And then the aspirant says to the hunter, the eyes that saw are not able to speak, and the mouth which can speak did not see, and therefore what do I tell you? And that is how he escapes the situation, and Lord Shiva gives him darshan and says that he is pleased with him. So Swami always says that when you are in such situations, use tact. But through this story also gives us a very subtle but strong hint that in order to get that tact, get that yukti, pray to the Lord, seek His guidance. So that is one way we can get out of situations where we think that there is no other choice other than to tell a lie.
Right. And you know, the important thing what you said is pray to the Lord. It is all about insight. You know, whenever we are faced with a moral dilemma, I think it's always that insight, that gut feeling which actually guides you.
Mm.
But the other way is, if you are one who has taken to the vow of speaking the truth, even speaking the truth as we know it in the world, if that is your vow, and if you stick to that, I think what repercussions would come out of that vow will be taken care of the Lord.
You know, by the Lord.
By the Lord. Hmm. One of the best stories is there in the Mahabharata.
Okay.
You know, the last day of the battle, all the Kauravas are vanquished except Duryodhana.
The eldest brother.
And the final battle, he's supposed to go for a battle with Bhima. They would have a maze fight. And that's the story. So he's like lost all his resources. Then he goes to his uncle, you know, Shakuni, and asks him, what do I do now? Or I think Shakuni is killed by then.
Yeah. Shakuni is killed by then.
Right. I think he goes and asks somebody what is to be done. And he's guided that the best person who can actually tell you is Yudhishthira. And he says, Yudhishthira will not lie. And Yudhishthira will give you the best solution to be the one who is to win this battle.
Okay.
Imagine Yudhishthira is the enemy who has fought this long battle, who has himself given so many losses. I mean, who has suffered so many losses. It is told that if you go and ask him, he will tell you the truth as to how you can win this battle.
How you can become invincible.
Right. So Duryodhana goes to Yudhishthira and asks him, what do? I want to win this battle with your brother Bhima.
Oh God.
And Yudhishthira, the one who is given to sticking to truth, he gives him the solution that you go to Gandhari. And you know, he says you go in.
Gandhari is Duryodhana's mother.
Who has actually blindfolded herself.
Since birth.
Not since birth, since her marriage to Dhritarashtra.
Because her husband is blind,
she says, I take upon this blindness. And because of that virtue, she actually has so much of power in her vision.
You know, just a small deviation here, Prem. Not a deviation actually, a very rightful one. Swami says that when you control your drishti has so much power. And that is why, you know, this concept of darshan. And Swami has also said it, whatever my eyes fall on are transmuted. Because one who has complete control over the drishti has great power in the eyes. And when the sight of such a person falls on us, our lives are transformed. And that is the reason we go to temples, we go to visit holy people and hope that their drishti falls on us. And this is the advice actually that Yudhishthira tells Duryodhana, that your mother she has had complete control over her drishti. So there's great power in her drishti. If her sight falls on you once, you will be invincible.
And that's what he says, that you go to your mother in the nude, and when she sees you, your body will become impregnable. It will become, you know, you don't need any armory after that. So that's what is told to him. So the story goes that he goes to his mother to get that final benediction.
Yeah, and he's completely naked when he's going.
Right. And that time Krishna comes in and changes Duryodhana's mind. He says that how can you go like this? Even though it's your mother, he starts quoting some, you know, Shastra, saying that it is wrong to go for a man of certain age to go to his mother in this form and all that, and forces him to wear something like a loincloth. The story goes that he wears a leaf.
A banana leaf to cover his groin area.
Right. So when he goes like that, the story goes that Gandhari sees Duryodhana, but then that part alone, the thigh part is left without that protection. And then Krishna tells Bhima that you attack him there, and that's how Duryodhana gets killed. If you look at the story, you know, here is Yudhishthira who is given to the vow of truth. And the Lord comes in and protects him from what would be the
disaster,
disasters which would result from that virtue.
Beautiful. I mean, it goes to show that, well, for one, so two solutions we have here. If we are in a situation where we are supposed to tell a lie, we can either use tact, and we should pray to the Lord. Or the third thing is, stick to your virtue and know that it will protect you. That is what Swami says in like Dharmo Rakshati Rakshita. It will protect you because if you have really been truthful, I mean, truthfully abiding by that virtue itself will protect you. Dear listeners, this is not an all comprehensive answer, but these are just thoughts that Prem and myself, we have pondered about in our reflections, in our reading of Swami's discourses and our understanding of Swami's discourses. Please do write in with your thoughts, your feelings, because this satsang about the four values will continue next week definitely, and we will definitely be discussing all the inputs that you send in so that we can build on this satsang. And as always, this is a satsang that's a global satsang.
So having said that, we offer this humble effort of ours, and humble in all senses it really is, because every of these concepts, you know, just we were talking before, Swami has spoken so much about, he's left us with a wealth, and we are having the duty of excavating this wealth, and this is our little humble endeavor in that process. We offer this effort of ours at Swami's lotus feet, and we pray to him to bless us in this journey of ours. Dear listeners, we're going to leave you with a song. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined as always by Chandu with his program Love to Love.
Hayat karo. कृपा करो भगवान।